Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101, Section 1 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 24, delivered on May 1, 2012. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, review for Exam 2. It is the same format as Exam 1, 50 questions, multiple choice and true and false. And it picks up where Exam 1 left off, maybe a little bit of overlap. Certainly, you'll need to remember some of the key points of basic supply and demand and all that from Exam 1, but I don't directly ask questions from Exam 1 material. Now, as far as this exam goes, much of it, it's not as mathematical. There's a little math in it. There's no question about that, but there's more memory work in it. First and foremost, you need to know the antitrust laws. Make sure you know those, okay? I will overlap that material a little bit from Exam 1, but you need to know your antitrust laws. The Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, Clayton, Federal Trade Commission Act, both the Clayton and the Federal Trade Commission Act were 1914. Clayton was an amendment to Sherman to tighten it up. And then there was the Chain Store Act, Robinson-Patman Act in 1936. And then there was that last attempt to stop the massive mergers that were going on in 1976, the Scott Hart-Rodino Act. It was the Scott Hart-Rodino Antitrust Improvement Act of 1976. Let me go through a couple of the provisions. Just the PowerPoint will be up. Review it, but let me get through a couple of the provisions. Sherman, if you see conspiracies, that's Sherman. Sherman was one that brought up conspiracies first, and it was pretty vague, and that was one of the points that it was taken down on. Sherman Antitrust Act made unlawful conspiracies, combinations, and other business agreements that served to restrain trade. Now, make sure you know that, yes, Sherman did bust a couple of major trusts. One of them was the Standard Oil Trust of New Jersey. That was Rockefeller's trust, John D. Rockefeller's trust. It also broke American Tobacco. And I lightly mentioned, I wouldn't hold you to it, it also was used to bust up a securities trust, securities investment trust. Now, when it went to the Supreme Court was given two ways to consider enforcement, a structural test and a performance test. A structural test would have been per se, P-E-R-S-E. In other words, is it a monopoly? If it is, then it's guilty under Sherman. That would have been the structural test. The performance test requires two steps. First, that it is a monopoly. And second, that it has caused measurable harm by being a monopoly. The Supreme Court chose to consider violations of Sherman by the performance test, which would be much harder for prosecutors to show. So that means that Congress had to come back around in 1914 with two new pieces of legislation. One, the Clayton Act, was an amendment to Sherman, laying out specific per se violations. For example, the Clayton Act prohibited exclusivity clauses. In other words, it prevented tie-in sales and bundling. It also prohibited price discrimination, where no actual cost difference was involved. It did some other things, and you can find in the PowerPoint some other things. Now, in the same year, 1914, Congress passed the Federal Trade Commission Act. That was a standalone piece of legislation. It first and foremost established a regulatory body that would oversee enforcement of antitrust laws. It established a regulatory body that would oversee enforcement of antitrust laws. This took the pressure off courts and off prosecutors, because then this agency could go after companies that were acting in violation of antitrust law. This agency was, of course, called the Federal Trade Commission. It also tied up a few loose ends, a few more per se violations, including predatory pricing, which was made unlawful under the Federal Trade Commission Act. It was made specifically unlawful to price a product below the marginal cost of production if the intent was to harm competition. Again, it made it unlawful to price a product below the marginal cost of producing the product if the company were putting those low prices on things just to destroy their competitors. Now remember that loss leaders are not predatory pricing, because the intent is not to hurt the competitor, it's just to get people to come to your store so they can pay higher prices for other things. Now, in 1936, another amendment to Sherman was put into play. That was the Robinson-Patman Act, otherwise known as the Chain Store Act, which was an attempt to stop the proliferation of the giant chain stores that were wrecking the mom-and-pop operations. The Chain Store Act, otherwise known as the Robinson-Patman Act. The last major piece of legislation would have been the Scott Hart-Rodino Antitrust Improvement Act of 76, which gave the Federal Trade Commission the authority to review mergers and acquisitions to ensure that they did not unduly harm competition. Again, it gave the Federal Trade Commission the authority to review mergers and acquisitions to ensure that they did not unduly harm competition within markets. The Federal Trade Commission Act was amended in the 30s to give broad authority to the Federal Trade Commission to prohibit unfair and deceptive business practices. Wide authority. The Federal Trade Commission more or less considered this the way by which it could stop phony false advertising. In other words, it focused on the deceptive, but did not put so much emphasis on the unfair. Now that's the history of the legislation that was passed trying to stop the growth of monopolies and oligopolies. Largely since the 1930s, there's been very little that has been done to really stop the growth of monopolies. It took up a great deal of strength in the 1990s, and now we are in a position where industries are heavily concentrated. We can't even measure the concentration. Now, on the exam, I'm going to ask you about the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index. I'll have you calculate it. Remember that there's a two-step. First of all, you find the market shares, and then from the market shares, you figure out the HHI. What was I thinking? Now, the two-step test is first, if the post-merger HHI in a merger is above 1800, you go to the second test. If the jump in the HHI was more than 100 points, the Federal Trade Commission will disqualify the merger or acquisition. So it's a two-step test, and I will test you on the exam. I'll say, first of all, here's an industry. What's the HHI? And then in the next question, I'll say, here's a proposed merger. Will this merger be qualified or disqualified by the FTC? So it'll be a two-banger question. That is, and so you can see that the antitrust will take up a fair portion of the exam. Labor will take up a fair portion of the exam. Make sure you know the Knights of Labor, it was a labor movement, not a labor union. It was highly influenced by the socialist theory from Karl Marx that was sweeping Europe. And a splinter group led by Samuel Gompers broke away from the Knights of Labor and formed the first true labor union in the United States, the American Federation of Labor, the AFL. The early days of labor were fraught by anti-labor sentiment within the government, as well as, of course, within companies. There was more of a pro-labor tilt in the 19-teens for a while, but then it turned anti-labor again until we get to the 1930s with the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the takeover of Congress by Democrats. The Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 was shot down by the Supreme Court. It gave workers the right to collectively bargain. Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional. Roosevelt threatened to put more than 9 justices into the Supreme Court so that the Supreme Court would have a majority in favor of his policies. The Supreme Court got the message, so in 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act came through, the Supreme Court found that that was constitutional. That gave workers the right to organize, to collectively bargain. It was in the same era that we got a minimum wage. There had never been anything like that in the United States before. I won't push too hard because I didn't go as far as I wanted to with the labor side of the equation, but you should know those features. know some of the presidents who were involved. In the 19-teens, we had more of a liberal pro-labor president. That was Woodrow Wilson. We then went in the 1920s through a series of Republican presidents. The economy, the rich got much richer. The income distribution began to separate out. The poor got poor. Middle class got squeezed out. And finally, we had the crash of 1929 of the stock market. Herbert Hoover was the president. The country blamed him for the Great Depression that was gripping the country, kicked him out, kicked the Republicans out of Congress, and installed a slate of Democrats and put in a president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in 1932, who changed the entire equation about the relationship between government and the governed. We began to see the first Social Security. We saw minimum wage laws. Federal government specifically began to protect the rights of workers to organize, collectively bargain. It no longer defended companies by sending in federals when there were labor actions and all that. Know that about labor. Very important. Now, let me go into some other things that will be important for the exam. That's labor. And, of course, it's not comprehensive what I've told you, but it gives you a good idea. Make sure you know about some of the basics of income, poverty, and prosperity. Specifically, you should know what the Lorenz curve is, what the Gini coefficient is. You should have some broad idea of where countries fall on the spectrum of Gini coefficients. You should obviously know that South America and Africa are two of the worst places in the world as far as income distribution goes. That Scandinavia and Japan are two of the best places, as is Europe. Canada is not a bad place either. Same for Australia. The United States has growing income disparity. And there are other measures that we can use to consider, for example, GDP, per capita GDP. Know each one, the strength, and why it's not the only one we use. For example, GDP measures the overall wealth of a nation, but it doesn't measure the average wealth of each individual. Per capita GDP tells us the average wealth of individuals, households, but it doesn't tell us the distribution of income. And know some of the other measures too. What about infant mortality rates? Where does the United States fall? Does it have a low infant mortality rate? One of the lowest in the world, as we would expect, or is that not the case? Make sure you know those kinds of soft measures, which are still very important. Now, on this exam, I will probe monopolies again and the structures of markets. Just make sure you know some of the basics that are important about industry structure. For example, monopolistic competition. Is that a market let's try it this way. If I were to tell you product differentiation, you should know that that is monopolistic competition. The companies differentiate their products from each other to try to create mini monopolies. In the long run, it fails. The competitors overrun them. That's why it's competition in the long run. If I were to use the word strategic, that would be an oligopoly. They are strategic thinkers, strategic planners, strategic pricers, strategic competitors. If I were to tell you one company, that's a monopoly. If I were to tell you atomistic companies, price takers, something like that, that's perfect competition. Make sure if I give you a graph of a monopoly, the demand, marginal revenue, marginal cost, you know how to find the output level and the price. I did that on a quiz. You make sure you know how to do that for the exam. Remember, don't let me bluff you by giving you a place that's not where the price is. You go up to the demand curve to find the price. Now, I also went into risk and insurance. Make sure you know the terminology as much as anything else. Know what I mean by adverse selection. Looked like on the quiz you were pretty good on that. What's cherry picking and moral hazard? Redlining. Looking about something here. Yeah, on that idea of industry structure, make sure you know the basic assumptions. Let me go through, make sure that you've got these. Perfect competition. The firms are atomistic. In other words, each one is so small compared to the entire market that each firm, no single firm or even a little group of firms can have any impact on the market. Whether they live or die, whether they try to plan and fix their prices, doesn't have any impact because they're so small compared to the massive size of the demand curve. Another word you would see in perfect competition, price takers. Whatever the price is set by forces way beyond the company's ability to control. Easy entry and exit. Those would be perfect competition terms as well. It's relatively easy to get in, relatively easy to get out in perfect competition. Also, of course, in perfect competition, technological diffusion is very rapid. In other words, if some company figures out a new way to do something, well, about every other company is going to know how to do it within a fairly short period of time. It's hard to hold your secrets to yourself in perfect competition. Okay, now let me take you to monopolistic competition. First of all, there are many firms. They're fiercely competing against each other. And their main way of competing against each other is through product differentiation. They try to make their products different from their competitors, even though really, just like in perfect competition, the products are perfect substitutes or very close substitutes. The companies differentiate their products from one another. The way they do this is through marketing. And remember, marketing isn't just advertising. Marketing is a globe. Price, product, promotion, placement, all that kind of stuff, distribution. So it's not just advertising, but advertising is the one that we see is the most visible. That's how monopolistic competitors try to make themselves miniature monopolies in their product in the short run. In the long run, it's just not worth it. The marginal cost of one more advertising campaign just is not going to is not worth the extra revenue you get from holding the price up for another for the length of another campaign. And you eventually give up and let the products fall into perfect competition. Now again, oligopolies. Generally, few firms, although there could be more than two or three. The word is strategic. The word is strategic. So that means that strategic pricing, strategic planning, strategic competition, they don't collude. It looks like they do. There's always the claims, well, there's a conspiracy, and all that kind of stuff. And there's constantly, they're being dragged before Congress, their executives are, well, were you working together to make prices higher on oil? That's not how they work. They just all think alike. They all think way into the future. They all think not about tomorrow or next year, but they are all planning for where their competitors will be, where their money will come from, where the resources are, way out there. What technologies will be in place, way out there. That's the big thing about about oligopolies. Now, as far as monopolies go, of course, one firm, they are price setters. The other term is price seekers. I ask this often. Don't get it wrong. A monopolist faces the entire market demand curve. A monopolist faces the entire globe of demand. It's the only company that sells the product, so it faces the entire world's demand. That is exactly the opposite of perfect competition, where a single company is so tiny compared to the demand of the world that it can't see it. All it can see is its little corner and its little foot traffic or its car traffic. It doesn't see the globe at all. In the middle there, the monopolistic competitors try to make their product into the global demand by separating their product from all the other ones. They essentially create global demand for their product. But that can last only so long before it costs too much to just keep doing it. Eventually, the barbarians overrun the gates. I'm trying to think. Again, the only real math I'm going to put on this test will be the HHI, okay? And I mean, that's almost no-brainer stuff. Just make sure you have a calculator that can do squares and all that kind of stuff. But as far as math goes, there were some math things in this, but there's so much memory work for this part of the course that I minimize the math attack on you to the extent that I can, because you've got a lot of memorization that has to be done on this test. Now, do you have any questions for me about this? If you ask me something, is this going to be on the exam and it's not there, I'll say no, I'm not going to ask that. Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Cassell.
The two-step process again for the
HHI. Okay, the FTC will say, is the post-merger HHI greater than 1800? Okay? If the answer to that is yes, that triggers the second test. Did the HHI jump from pre to post merger by more than 100 points? Okay. Yes, absolutely. And along that same line, make sure you know what the polar ends of the HHI are. Zero would indicate perfect competition. 10,000 would represent a pure monopoly. It's only at 1800, though, that the Justice Department considers an industry to be uncompetitive. And so, but remember that all the, what some of the problems with the HHI, for example, a company like a Google or an Apple or companies like that, they can gobble up tiny little companies one after the other, and it doesn't blip the HHI. And yet what they're doing is essentially reshaping the competition of the marketplace by absorbing the best of these little tiny companies and letting the worst just flop around and die. They are really, in a sense, reinforcing their monopolistic position. It was 2 weeks ago that the FTC got tired of Google playing around with answering some questions about its antitrust activities. And so the FTC, showing the great concern that the government has about monopolies, slapped Google with a $25,000 fine, to which Google responded, "Did you feel something?" Yeah, you know, I could just hear Google, "Ow, ow, my little finger, ow." But that's the competitive framework in which we are dealing now. That antitrust law, there is effort to enforce it, but for the most part, two things are going on. One is there was such lax effort to stop concentrations of industries for so long that we've got some major, major concentrated industries. Unfortunately, that was deliberate on the part of the government. The last, and again, forgive me for being a little political, the last great Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, in his last speech when he was leaving office, he warned the country, he warned Congress. He said, beware of the military-industrial complex. This mass of companies and military needs and giant companies that would more or less take over not just our economy but our political environment. After Eisenhower, you had these quote-unquote enlightened liberals in the administration of John Kennedy who just completely dismissed that. They saw the way to the future as allowing concentrated industries to grow, more concentrated, get bigger, get stronger, become more capable of creating incredible projects, and less capable of having financial catastrophe. The argument in the time frame that was advanced by one of the leading neo-Keynesian theorists was one of what was called countervailing forces. The idea was this. Yeah, it could be a very big problem. Concentrated, monopolistic, or oligopolistic industries. Yeah, that could be a big problem. But what you can have is a balance of power. These massive concentrated industries, these huge, powerful labor unions, and an aggressive regulator in the United States government itself. And all of these would act like a triad for the last half of the 20th century and beyond. We could grow militarily, industrially, commercially, and we could improve everyone's lives in this way. And we could fight communism more effectively this way than any other way, and protect the American way of life. That was the theory. It was still in play even in the 1990s. This wasn't just a Republican pro-business thing. This was Republicans and Democrats both. And even to this day, they all believe this. They still believe this, that we gotta have these massive concentrated industries. They're the ones who can make the incredible projects happen. They're the ones who can keep our employment levels up. They're the ones who can make us still the leader of the free world. Even after we've seen all of the damage, even after you see what the fact that employment is not best in those kinds of markets, Democrats and Republicans, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, they still believe this, that we can't bust these industries up, crush them, shatter them into perfect competition or monopolistic competition. We can't do that because we have to have these massive engines of production, of development of technologies. So that's what you're facing for your lives. You can't stop it. You just have to live in the shadow of an empire that is both corporate and government in its orientation. Do you have any other questions about the exam? Go ahead.
What's the difference between moral and moral hazard?
Moral hazard, when you are being insured, when you're insured against something, you have an incentive, either conscious or unconscious, to take risks that you wouldn't otherwise take. Now, if you act consciously on that protection you have, I've got insurance, then if you're acting consciously, that's moral hazard. If it's, on the other hand, that you're just kind of unconsciously, I don't pay attention to these risks because, you know, I guess I'm insured, that's morale hazard. Quite often, you know, we don't drive like blind trout because, well, I got insurance, I'll have a big accident here. It's more of we don't think in terms that we would if we were not insured. You will tend to take on risks unconsciously. In many situations that people 100, 200 years ago would not have taken. And that's morale hazard. When you deliberately look for risk because you are insured, well, that's moral hazard. I won't get into it too much, but there are, to give you an idea of how extensive this concept goes, it would have probably been very early in your lifetimes, in the mid-1990s, it would have been early in your lives. There was a big push by consumer advocacy groups to force the automakers to put airbags in cars, to actually mandate it, that all cars, new cars being produced, would have to have an airbag in them to protect the driver. You know, this was a big thing. The auto manufacturers were saying, we can offer this as an option, but man, these things are expensive. This is $600 on the cost of a car. We can offer airbags, but we don't want to be forced, because that would just jack up every car's price. No. Well, the consumer advocates were beating the drum. We've got to make the world safer for people to drive like maniacs, blah, blah, blah. Secretly, behind the scenes, this whole mandatory airbags in car movement was being pushed by the auto insurance industry. They were using sock puppets of consumer protection advocates to get airbags in cars. Because obviously, if the airbags are in cars, not as many people will get killed in accidents. Not as big, the payouts will be better. And so the insurance companies were behind the scenes pushing this mandatory legislation. Auto manufacturers said, we don't want to do that. That's going to jack up the price of cars terribly. Well, Congress yielded to the behind-the-scenes pressure from the insurance companies, and they made it mandatory, airbags in cars. And the price of cars, sure enough, went up. It's they just jacked the price of cars. Well, yeah, they cost a lot. The technology sucked, by the way. It's still not great in some ways. You ever have an airbag go up? Yeah, I mean, it won't just kill you. Don't worry, though. It'll take off your head. You won't feel anything. You know, you might see yourself rolling along for a while, but okay. And also, airbags, if you've ever had an airbag go off, I nearly lost the tips of several fingers when an airbag went off. The heat from the airbag as it deflates is just ungodly. But anyway, all is well. The consumers are all protected. Well, it didn't take too long, just a couple of years, before something awful was noticed by the insurance companies. People were living through car accidents where they would have otherwise been killed. Now, if you understand what that means that in a car accident, your entire body, in a head-on collision, your entire body is traumatized. What kills you is the trauma to the thoracic region or to the head. You're killed by the crushing blow of your chest against the steering wheel or whatever else is there. Well, because airbag was going to protect you from getting killed with the thoracic trauma or the head trauma, it was going to leave you mangled from the waist down with the trauma to your lower body. You see, the insurance companies found out it cost a hell of a lot less to pay a death benefit than it did to rehabilitate a person whose lower half had been turned into essentially a hamburger. Person after person was living through car accidents, mangled, and it cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and years of rehabilitative therapy and equipment to fix these people back up. And the insurance companies said, we could have paid a death benefit that would have been a hell of a lot cheaper than this. So then came the push. Mandatory seatbelts in cars. Yeah, by God, click it or ticket. We care about your health and safety, by God. No, they don't. The insurance companies, again, sock puppets, talk to them. And so there you are again. Sure enough, it's all about safety, seatbelts. Dude, we had seatbelts before the airbags. You know, you could have just mandated the seatbelts and then we wouldn't have gone through this with the expensive airbags and cars that save our lives and mangle our asses and everything below, the south of the ass. But you see, that's the idea there, you see. And interestingly enough, that actually ties into moral hazard. In a complex way, it ties into the moral hazard. You see, because, of course, with an airbag, who's going to wear a seatbelt? Because, you see, I'm protected in an accident. And then you have an accident, and the person after the accident, the emergency workers open the door, and they say, Jesus, dude, can you really do that with legs? You know? But you see, there was this incentive to actually not wear seatbelts. And of course, now we have to have a law, and then you have these creepy-ass cops who stand on corners looking into your car to see if you got your seatbelt on and all that kind of stuff. Moral hazard. And in that case, it's actually more like a combination of moral and morale hazard. And it had to be stopped by law, again, to protect those insurance companies. And we know how much protection they need from you evil consumers. That's all I have for you. Thank you.